copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Well, welcome to this session on the apologetics of sex. Let's get to work and start to talk about sex and how we as Christians can think about and talk about and wrestle with the issues around sexuality. Before we do that, let's pray. Lord, we are so thankful that we can meet together. Still, even though we are separated by so long distances, thank you for this opportunity we have to come together to think about and wrestle about a very important and wonderful and painful subject. Lord, I want to pray that you will be with us through your Holy Spirit to guide us, to challenge us, to encourage us. So we lift ourselves and this afternoon we lift it up in front of you. And Lord, we pray that you will do your work with us and for us. In the name of Jesus, I pray. Amen. My first presentation, I will make some introductory comments and then give more of a broad view on the different alternatives we have in terms of thinking about sex. But let me start with some introductory remark, which are very important for me. As a speaker, I feel really, really sorry that we cannot meet together in a room and meet face to face, eye to eye, and really sit down to talk in a much more personal way than is possible in our situation. Because these questions on sexuality, they are deeply personal. And can in many instances be difficult questions and also painful questions. Most of us are coming to questions on sex with different kinds of history. Of course, for some it's an unproblematic history. For some it's a very mainly a joyful history. But for many of us, it's also a painful history. Of sorrow, of pain, of guilt, of shame, because of what other people have done to us, or maybe because of what we ourselves have done. So I'm deeply aware of that. There are so many dimensions that we cannot really touch on in this kind of digital meeting. Many of us comes from church situations where where there have been too little talk and openness about sex. So I saw this picture on outside the church. Please, no explanations inside the church. I'm sure it was directed towards the guides that they were not allowed to disturb the setting of the church by a lot of historical explanations. But in terms of sex, so many churches have actually acted like this, no explanations. So the churches have been either silent or they've just assumed a certain perspective without explaining it or arguing for it and not keeping it open to discussion. And that has created, that creates a very strange and inhuman atmosphere around issues of sex. And of course, it's whenever we talk about ethical issues, we are immediately drawn into this dilemma of ideals and a reality that does not match up to the ideals. And in terms of sex, We have this dilemma too, that there are certain ideals, and then we have the human reality, which often differs quite a lot from the ideals. How to handle that? How to cope with this tension? Well, one way, which is very common in the more liberal churches, is to lowering the ethical bar, to start to change the ethical standards. So we adjust our ethical thinking so it accords with our fallen reality. That's one way to do it. Then you don't have attention any longer. The other way, more common in evangelical or Bible-believing circles, where we hide the gap and we pretend. And that creates an attitude of hypocrisy, where people are pretending things that are not really true. And the real danger is to be exposed, because if your true human reality is exposed, then you are faced with harshness, or you are just dismissed from the community. And none of these two attitudes reflects the gospel. The gospel attitude, the gospel solution to this dilemma, to this tension between ideals and our human, sinful, broken reality, the gospel solution is first God's grace, forgiveness for our past, forgiveness for sin and guilt, and then God's Spirit enabling us to move in a new direction. So sanctification. So I hope we can have this afternoon together with this gospel mentality where God's grace and God's Spirit is the solution to this dilemma, this tension between ideals and reality. I recently learned about a Japanese thing called, or term called, kintsugi. I don't know if I pronounce it right, but kintsugi. I read it from a book called Broken and Beautiful. And they said, the Japanese have an ancient tradition called kintsugi. Instead of discarding a beautiful bowl that has been broken, they use gold to repair it, creating a vessel that is unique and even more valuable than before. Kintsugi illustrates the truth that nothing is ever truly broken beyond repair. Rather than hiding the brokenness, the gold creates something new and cherished. And I thought that was such a beautiful picture of the gospel, that God in his sovereignty can make something beautiful out of also our broken lives. Also the brokenness that we bring to him. So that's an illustration of the kind of attitude and the kind of hope we can have as gospel people, kintsugi. Now, when we talk about sex, a lot of the culture around us are saying to us, why are you so obsessed with sex? What's wrong with you people? Relax. Why all this talk about sex? I find that a very strange accusation. I don't think the churches are obsessed with sex. On the contrary, it's contemporary culture that is totally obsessed with sex and talks about sex and shows sexual images all the time. And no one is accusing secular people, if they have an opinion about sex, of being obsessed with sex. So I think sex is important for us as human beings, and everyone has the right to think through issues of sex, including disciples of Jesus, of course, including the Christian church. So I think this is a faulty accusation that we are obsessed with sex. We have a distinctive perspective on a number of issues relating to sex, but that is not the same as an obsession. Other people say to us that we are hypocrites. And there are some truth to this accusation, but we need to think carefully here. A hypocrite, what is that? A hypocrite is someone who accuses other people for wrongdoing while pretending themselves to pass the test. But in reality, they are practicing the sin they condemn. That is a hypocrite. The problem here lies not in the fact that you teach a certain moral principle, nor in the fact that you yourself have failed to live up to it. But the problem with a hypocrite is that you pretend to apply it when you don't. If we take another issue, think of the principle, you should not lie. Most people would agree on that principle. Yet, everyone has been untruthful. We have lied sometimes in our lives. Does that make us hypocrites? Yeah, in a sense. But only if we claim that we have never broken the principle. To say, I agree with the principle, you should not lie, even though I have lied myself, does not make me a hypocrite. It makes me a sinner, yes, absolutely, but not a hypocrite. So here is a very important question about honesty, about the readiness to admit that we have broken the principles that we affirm. And that is, of course, a very Christian attitude. We are Christian because we confess that we have not been perfect. We are sinners. And that's why we need the gospel of Jesus Christ. So I hope we can have this afternoon together with this kind of attitude. As Mark Twain has said, we are all like the moon. We each have a dark side. We are all like the moon. We each have a dark side. I not long ago came in contact with the writing of Frank Sheed, a book from the 1950s, but I thought it was a really, really, he had some really, really good points. He said this when he was writing about sex. The typical modern man practically never thinks about sex. And you think, what? Well, listen on. He dreams of it, of course, by day and by night. He craves for it. He pictures it. He is stimulated or depressed by it, drools over it. But this frothing, steaming activity is not thinking. Drooling is not thinking. Picturing is not thinking. Craving is not thinking. Dreaming is not thinking. Thinking means bringing the power of the mind to bear. Thinking about sex means striving to see sex in its innermost reality and in the function it is meant to serve. So I hope this is also what we are going to do this afternoon, to apply some hopefully good thinking, some real thinking to the issues. Okay, that was my introductory remark. Now, when I've tried to look into the issue of sex, historically, culturally, I've come to the conclusion that individuals and cultures basically have moved in four different directions when it comes to sex. There are four main groups of how you can think about sex. Some culture move in the direction of seeing this as an area with no boundaries or very few boundaries. The direction is to try to free sex as much as possible. To have a quantitative view of sex, where the more sex with the more people in the more different ways, the better. Of course, there needs to be some boundaries maybe, but the direction is to try to release sex and sexual power as much as possible. So in the ancient, here's a description of life in ancient Greece and how men were viewing sex. Mistresses we keep for the sake of pleasure, concubines for the daily care of the body, but wives to bear us legitimate children. So sex with in many different relationships. Or we can think of, if we think about more contemporary Western culture, we can think of the Playboy philosophy. Sex is the driving force on the planet. We should embrace it, not see it as the enemy. Hugh Hefner. So that's one way to go. Another way to go is to see the opposite, to say, look at those cultures that have done this boundless thing. It's selfish, it's ugly, it's destructive, because sex is so powerful, and if you use it wrong, you hurt yourself and you hurt other people. Now let's go the other way, to suppress it as much as possible. Of course, we need to have sex, otherwise humanity dies out, but that is the function, to procreate. So some of the church fathers seem to have this view. Here's Clement of Alexandria. Sex is only for procreation. Sexual desire came with a fall in his thinking. Ideally, sex for procreation within marriage should be without passion or desire or lust. So limiting sex to procreation and then making other dimension of sex into something that is shady or shameful or with no dignity. The third way to go is to say, no. You should think the absolute opposite way. Sex is actually a divine force. It connects you with God. It's a way to salvation. And more culture than we imagine have had this kind of attitude. So often the religious cult and cultic prostitution have gone hand in hand. In antiquity, it was like that. In the countries around Israel in the Old Testament, you had temple prostitutes. And you combine two of the strongest forces within humanity, namely the spiritual longing and the sexual drive, into one. In the Western world, the tantric tradition of Hinduism has often been elevated here. This is the way to think about sex. You connect with a mystical, spiritual dimension when you're having sex. And fourthly, some cultures have said, now, the way we need to look at sex is to find the right area for sex. It does not connect us with God, per se, but it should not be suppressed. It's a good thing, but within the right relationships and within the right area. So they have tried to find, to draw the line saying, outside of these boundaries, sex takes up a destructive function. But inside those boundaries, sex should be affirmed. Sex is good. Sex is a positive force that we can explore and that we should say yes to. So trying to balance And of course, culture have drawn the lines differently. Exactly where is the border? But the mentality has been to affirm sex, but not boundless, not as a way to God, but as an important dimension of human life that can be valued, but within certain relationships, within a certain area. Okay, so that would be my more general introduction to the whole area of sex. Then I want to look more specifically on our culture and the sexual revolution that has shaped our own culture so much and influences the way people think about sex today, and of course influences so much what's going on in the thinking of Christians, because we are part of this specific culture. And you can say the sexual revolution has shaped the mind of Westerners, but very quickly it has also become a global phenomenon, shaping the minds of people also outside of the Western culture. So, the sexual revolution. In some ways, you could draw the lines for the sexual revolution back to my country, to Sweden. Sweden was in the forefront of the sexual revolution in the 50s and 60s. And here you see the world's most famous sex icon during the 50s and 60s, Anita Ekberg, the Swedish actress. And she became world famous in the movie La Dolce Vita. That movie begins with a scene where there are two helicopters flying over Rome. Under one helicopter, there is a huge statue of Christ, and it's they are moving the statue from one location to place it in a new location. And in the other helicopter, there is a small group of journalists, young male journalists, who are there to cover this event of the moving of the Christ statue. But when they're flying over Rome, on the top floor of an hotel, a number of young, beautiful women in bikinis are sunbathing. And when the journalists see this, they tells the driver of the pilot of the helicopter to stop and to circle around the hotel with the hotel roof with the young women. And they are trying to make sign languages with them. They want to have contact with them. And the helicopter with Christ just disappears. Now, that's a very powerful image of what Fellini wanted to say. The old culture represented by Jesus Christ and the view of male and female and sex within that culture is now going away. And now a new way is coming. But in order to understand the sexual revolution, we need to go further back than to Sweden or Italy in the 60s. We need to go back to Germany in the 20s and in the 30s, and to the man Wilhelm Reich. He's the man who coined the term the sexual revolution. And he was very, very critical towards the traditional view of sex and marriage. And he said that tradition in this area is the dead trying to suffocate the living. So therefore, we need to be free from tradition. And he wrote this book, The Sexual Revolution. The sexual revolution is in progress, and no power on earth will stop it. And here I think he was right. There was really a sexual revolution in progress, and it has been extremely successful, so much more successful than the Marxist revolution. And that revolution for Wilhelm Reich, is a revolution where we free sex from any meta-empirical authority of values. We cannot have any values from the outside or above us imposed on this area. It needs to be totally free. It needs to be me as an individual, totally free to express whatever I want in terms of sexuality. And Wilhelm Reich, he actually identifies human life with sexual pleasure. So here's a quote. "The pleasure of living and the pleasure of the orgasm are identical," he claimed. The pleasure of living, so the joy in life, and the pleasure of the orgasm, the sexual pleasure, they are identical. So if you don't have the sexual pleasure, you don't have a life of pleasure. And in order to have this revolution for Reich, we need to break free from tradition. So he wanted to see an abolition of lifelong monogamous marriage. He wanted to see a culture that is encouraging infantile children and adolescent sexuality. So sex is not only for adults, for grown-ups, but also for adolescents and for children. He saw every attempt to suppress any dimension of your sexuality as pathological. So that's destructive. And abstinence, to abstain from expressing yourself sexually, is also pathological. And he said that the category of sexual perversion, that something is outside of how it should be, a perversion, is of course when something is outside the right way. So sexual perversion should be eliminated. We cannot have that kind of category. Just open up the area for sexuality. So this is the sexual revolution according to Reich. And you have to really give to him that he has been extremely successful. His revolution has taken over our culture, with one exception. All of these points is affirmed today in our culture, with this exception. We have become even more hostile to involving sex, involving children in sexual relationships. That's the big taboo, pedophilia. But all the other aspects have been changed in our culture. The abolition of a lifelong monogamous marriage, that has happened. Of course, there still are monogamous marriages, but as an ideal, it has been undermined. But historically, we have to go even further back than to Wilhelm Reich. Actually, we have to go back all the way to the Enlightenment and to Marquis de Sade, the French libertine, who is called the founder of eroticism, who took the secular Enlightenment thinking to really its logical conclusion when it comes to sex. There's no God, there's no ultimate values or obligations. The individual person is totally free and therefore can express himself or herself in whatever way we want. And of course, Marquis de Sade took this to the ultimate consequences. And his life is a horrible life. And he hurted so many women. But actually, the ideas of the sexual revolution goes back to Marquis de Sade. If we want to formulate, so it's not too abstract, what has the sexual revolution accomplished? Well, it has accomplished this, that we have divorced sex from marriage. Of course, we can have sex when we are married, but it's not limited to sexual relationship within a marriage. You can have sex in many other relationships. We have divorced sex from love. Of course, you can have sex when you are in love or in a relationship where there are love and commitment, but you can also have sex in many other circumstances and relationships where there are no love and no commitment. We have divorced sex from permanence. So, of course, you can have sex in a permanent relationship, but you can also have one-night stands. We have divorced sex from procreation. Of course, it's still the way we procreate, but generally speaking, we tend to think about sex without its connection to procreation. And today there's a strange tendency to also separate sex from your body, what your body signals, what your body is. And we will come back to that when we talk about both homosexuality and transsexuality. So this is the big split, that we have wanted to release sex and make it into something that is unlimited and not connected to anything else but itself and to me as an individual who has the sexual urge. It's not related to anything else. But of course, there are always consequences following from ideas. There's always consequences following from ideas. And our culture has changed dramatically because of the sexual revolution. Now, let me say, everything in the sexual revolution has not been bad. And not everything was good before the sexual revolution. Far from it. If you study European history, you will see how ingrained prostitution and brothels are in European history. In the Christian, during the time when Christianity was the dominating worldview, you can see horrible things on a massive scale. And if you think about how men related to women, of course, there were so many ugly things. So I'm not saying it was good before the sexual revolution. It was problematic in many, many areas. And I'm not saying everything has been bad with the sexual revolution. There are some positive things, that we can talk much more freely about sex, that we affirm and value sex more than we did before, that we are not afraid or ignorant about knowledge about bodies and about sex. So there is a new freedom created around this area. So not everything is bad, and not everything was good before. So I really want to underline that. But still, there has been some both dramatic and tragic consequences of the sexual revolution. And if we have had a lot of time, we could go through statistics here. When I do teaching in Sweden on this area, I have a lot of statistics of what's happening in Sweden. It differs, of course, slightly from country to country. But there is a general picture everywhere where the sexual revolution is applied. And there's a consequence for family stability. At the year 1900, 1 or 2% of marriages ended in divorce in Sweden. Now it's over 50%. And for people cohabitating, the separations there are even higher. We have come into a situation where it's increasingly difficult to hold a family together, even though a majority of people really wants to build strong family relationships. The reason for this is not only the sexual revolution, but it's part of it. We can think in terms of how we view human life. In my country, we are 10 million inhabitants in Sweden. Every year, there is around 35,000 abortions. 35,000 abortions. If you take four countries of Europe, Germany, England, France, and Spain, then you have over 600,000 abortions every year. If you think about 600,000 abortions, that means 600,000 women. And the pain and the sorrow and the feeling of emptiness that so many of them are having because of the abortion, or the guilt feeling. Or you think of 600,000 aborted babies, or you think of 600,000 men that has contributed to a new life, and now that life is just removed. There's so much sorrow. If you think about the loss of family stability and what a divorce makes and how it hurts both the adults and if there are children, the children. You think about abortion, human life, and that is, of course, connected to our view of sex, that we are having sex, but we are not prepared to receive the fruits of our sexual acts. If you think about health, so sexually transmitted diseases is a kind of epidemic which causes a lot of, again, pain. The raising in terms of infertility is partly because of all the sexually transmitted disease. So there's been huge consequences. And if we had a time, we could have looked at divorce, abortion, sexually transmitted disease, statistics in terms of infidelity, when people are in committed relationships and then they still have sex with other people, prostitution, violence in terms of assault and rape, the whole issue we have today with consent, where it has been shown so clearly that the new way of thinking of sex is not working. And so many people have the feeling that they have been used in a relationship sexually. We can think of the of pornography and so on. So there's really a huge number of consequences. You can say that the sexual revolution, it has increased pleasure. I'm not denying that. Sex is a thing God has created that is connected with pleasure. So of course it has increased pleasure, but it has also increased a lot of pain. So it's not only a positive liberation, it has led to humiliation and debasement. I would argue that the sexual revolution is a failure even from an utilitarian perspective. And I think the last number of years where we have had the Me Too movement, that has shown it so clearly that we have not solved the issue of sex. We have not found the right way how to handle sexuality. We are hurting each other. And we can think of a number of famous men and how they have lived. And of course, there's so many unknown figures that are in a similar situation. So in my view, we are in a situation where it's more easy to discuss sex than in many years because the sexual revolution has failed. Francis Fukuyama, most well known for his book, The End of History, he has more recently written a book called The Great Disruption, which is the time for the last 50 years he calls the Great Disruption. And there he says, one of the greatest frauds perpetrated during the Great Disruption, the last 50 years, was the notion that the sexual revolution was gender neutral, benefiting women and men equally, and that it somehow had a kinship with the feminist revolution. In fact, the sexual revolution served the interest of men, and in the end put sharp limits on the gains that women might otherwise have expected from their liberation from traditional roles. So it's really clear here that the sexual revolution has benefited men, and women have lost in the sexual revolution. You can say that we have gradually in our culture moved from a sexual ethics of commitment, lifelong marriage, for better or worse, until death do us apart. We have moved to an ethics of closeness, where we have a series of relationships and we have sex as long as we feel love for each other, as long as we are close to each other. And that has given way to an ethics of pleasure, lust and mutual enjoyment. That is the only thing that is needed. And we have friends with benefits. So that's a long journey from an ethic of lifelong commitment to friends with benefits. I have some friends I play badminton with, and then I can have some friends I have sex with. It's on that level. Another way of looking at it is to say, we have used male, and as a man I would say, fallen male sexuality as the norm for humanity. So in the past, often women were called to be chaste, And as Margaret said, it was this kind of thinking that men have a stronger sexual urge and it's more difficult for him to control it. Therefore, it was up to the women to be the part that controlled sexuality so it not went wrong. So women were called to be chaste and men were excused for what they were doing sexually. I'm not at all defending that. But what has happened is that today women are challenged to pursue sex like men. And in both cases, the norm is male fallen sexuality. The alternative, what should have happened, is of course to encourage men to be responsible instead of encouraging women to do like men. Or to be more constructive, to challenge both men and women to grow in self-control. But self-control in the area of sexuality, that is not a high value in our culture or in the sexual revolution. That is seen as something destructive, pathological, to suppress. So therefore, the move has always been the other way, to encourage to live out your sexuality. And finally, another way to try to describe what has happened in the sexual revolution, that is our understanding of the sexual union. So in a Christian, in a biblical view, the sexual union of a man and a woman is a manifestation of belonging, is a covenantal sign, is a secret between two persons who have a unique bond, and that bond is manifested and renewed as a covenantal sign in the sexual act. So it signals the unique unity between those two individuals. We have moved from that view to see sex as an expression of love feelings. It's an intense emotional exchange. It's like the most potent body massage. Or, yeah, to, and then we have moved from an expression of love feelings where we exchange feelings and share an experience and share an enjoyment. It's, we have moved it to, it can also be only a physical pleasure. It can be an intense body massage. That's it. It's the most potent form of body massage. So that's some different ways of trying to describe what has happened in our culture. Now, I wanted to give you this picture as kind of background. Now we're going to move into the biblical view of sex and how we can talk about that. But before we do that, we will, of course, have a chance for questions, interaction, comments on this presentation. What do you think? What would you like to discuss or what I've been saying here? So I open up for question or comments or reactions or criticism, whatever you want to raise here. Okay, maybe we should do this. It can makes it more easy to.
Hi.
Yeah. Okay. Come on. Someone wanted to say something.
Okay, I don't know how to unmute. Okay, so I Fukuyama, I've always felt that. I have felt that the sexual revolution was not our freedom. Neither was being the given the sole role of chastity. Neither of them were freedoms, you know. Because, and I've always felt it was the male way of looking at sex. I was so glad that you said it that way. And what's interesting, there used to be a comedy. I think it was called Friends or something. And one of those women said, "Oh wow, you know, I can have sex with a man and I can go home and feel no guilt." And she said, "But this is what men have had all along." And suddenly they realized that this, what they thought was such sexual freedom, they didn't take it anywhere, and it didn't really change all that much. But it was interesting that such a, I guess in a way, worldly comedy actually exposed it in a very humorous way, how silly this sexual revolution really was.
Yeah, that's a good point. And there are many examples in literature and art and movies that describes the how we hurt each other by practicing the sexual revolution. But at the same time, even though we have the freedom to show how hurtful sex can be when the sexual revolution is applied, we have that freedom, but it's kind of off the limits to criticize the revolution itself. Because so much in our culture have been tied up to this sexual revolution. So you can criticize some consequences of it, like the Me Too movement, but people are blinded, I think, for the connections between what has happened in terms of sex, how that is related to the sexual revolution. So it's an interesting cultural situation where more and more people can see something destructive is going on here, but at the same time, very few are criticizing the reason why things have gone wrong here. So here I think we have an interesting situation of both formulating a critique and hopefully being able to show a better way forward for us as individuals, and maybe also for our culture. I like this quote very much by George Beagle. He says, he's a Roman Catholic theologian. And of course, in the view of sex, there's a lot of overlap and agreement between evangelical and Roman Catholic theologians. And he says like this: for the Christian, the first moral question shifts from what am I forbidden to do to how do I live a life of sexual love that conforms to my dignity as a human person? And I think this is really profound. I think this is really important. So much discussion about sex centers on the peripheral. So we ask, where is the line to be drawn so I know what is forbidden? And we focus a lot on those lines. And of course, they are not unimportant. At some point in discussion, there needs to be drawn lines. But the first moral question is not, what am I forbidden to do? But it is to broaden the question and relate it to, who am I? What conforms to my dignity as a human person? I'm created in the image of God. I am a person. What kind of sexual actions conforms to who I am as created in the image of God? So how do I live a life of sexual love that conforms to my dignity as a human person? I think that's a very good quote. I started this whole afternoon by quoting from Frank Sheed in Society and Sanity. And he challenged us to do some thinking on sex. And he continues to say this: our typical modern man, when he gives his mind to it at all, thinks of sex as something we are lucky enough to have. And he sees all its problems rolled into the one problem of how to get the most pleasure out of it. To that, he gives himself with immoderate enthusiasm and very moderate success. Success, in fact, can never be more than moderate because his procedure is folly. Sex is a power of the whole man, one power among many. And man is not an isolated unit, but bound to his fellows in society. And his life on earth is not the whole of life, but only a beginning. To use the power of sex successfully, we must use it in balance with the rest of our powers, for the service of the whole personality, within a social order, with eternity to come. So you see, he's trying to put sex into a bigger framework to balance it with the rest of our powers, for the service of our whole personality, of who we are as human beings, within a social order, how that relates to other people, and with eternity to come in mind. The consequence is long term. And all this is too complex a matter to be left to instinct or chance, to desire or mood, or the heat of blood, or the line of least resistance. It calls for hard thinking. It calls for hard thinking. We talk a lot about sex in our culture. I'm not sure it's always built upon hard thinking. When we turn to the Bible, it's interesting that there is a joyful and affirmative view of sex. We can think of this, the Song of Songs. So a whole book in the Bible devoted to love, romance, the sensual, where bodies are described and romantic and erotic desires are expressed. And there are many other places in the Bible which have this joyful perspective on sex. In Proverbs, it says this: the author is looking at God's creation is amazed about what God has created. There are three things that are too amazing for me, four that I do not understand: the way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a snake on a rock, the way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a young woman. Now, most translations translate it like this. It's the same in Swedish translations. But the Hebrew actually says, and the way of a man in a young woman. So he's specifically, it's not just generally thinking about male and female or the romantic longing. He's actually thinking of the sexual union between a man and a young woman. And he has put this in his amazement of what God has created. The way of an eagle in the sky, the snake on a rock, the ship on the high seas, and then male and female. So the church father's negative view on sex has no place within scripture. Of course, there's a strong condemnation of immoral sexual activity, but never on sex as such. That is affirmed. The biblical picture of sex is that it's created by God. It has been given to us for, of course, procreation. That is the obvious biological function of sex. We become God's co-creator. Co-creators. He could, of course, have created us as all directly if he wanted. But he has invited us to fulfill the earth, and he has given us the means to do it, and sex is the means. So procreation is part of our calling. But it's also a sign of unity between the man and his wife in marriage. So it has a function far beyond procreation. And in a long marriage, of course, procreation can only be part of be a reality during part of that marriage. And then that possibility is not there any longer, but sex is still there. And all through the marriage, sex can be a sign of unity. And then, of course, the way God has created our bodies is that it is when it's done right, it's connected to joy and pleasure and passion. So it's a multidimensional thing with sex. We should keep it together. There's at least those three dimensions of procreation, the sign aspect, and of course the joy and pleasure. For us as Christians, it's interesting that Jesus addressed these questions, and he addressed them in relationship to Genesis, to the beginning of everything. In Matthew 19, people are coming to Jesus with questions about divorce and remarriage. And instead of immediately answering those questions about divorce and remarriage, Jesus puts those questions into the wider context. Because before you can answer those questions, you need to understand what's the whole point of marriage. What was God's thought with his unity? And when Jesus is answering that, he says, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning, and then he quotes Genesis 1, made them male and female, and said, and then he quotes Genesis 2, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And then Jesus adds his own interpretation. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. And then he goes on to discuss divorce and remarriage, and he stipulates a situation where actually divorce can take place at the same time, he is really holding on to a very strict view on marriage. Now, this is not a place to discuss divorce and remarriage. But the interesting thing here is that Jesus refers back to the beginning, to Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. And there we have the place in the Bible where God gives us his basic perspective on why he has created us the way he has, that we are humans together, we are persons together, but we are here in two versions, male and female, with the same dignity, with the same value, with the same status, on the same level, created in the image of God, and still in two different versions. And if we take the place in Genesis 2, where we have this explanation of why is there now one man and one woman, and the verse that Jesus quotes, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother, let me see how, so I quote it right in English. Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Those words are said immediately after God has created the woman, and he brings the man and the woman together, and it comes as an explanation of the fact that there now are two distinct versions of his image, and what's the point of that? And if we break down what is said there, it seems to be God's idea that he wants to see a monogamous relationship between one man and one woman. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and cling to his wife. So polygamy is out of the picture. It's a heterosexual relationship. It's a man and his wife. We come back to this hotly debated issue later. Marriage is not any kind of relationship, but it is a kind of relationship that concerns other people. It's a social thing. And what is indicated here is that a marriage is established by a change of social status, that you leave your father and your mother. So you create something new. Before you're married, and not least in antiquity, you belonged to your father and mother. And of course, according to the commandment, you should honor the father and mother. But here you should leave and create a new unity. Of course, you can leave your father and mother without being married. But here is creating a new social unit. And then you're called to hold fast to each other. And that new unity where you hold fast to each other is completed in the sexual union. You're called to become one flesh. So that seems to be the general picture we have in Genesis, which is a definition of marriage, a monogamous heterosexual relationship that means a change of your social status in relationship to both your father and mother and to other people, where you promise to hold together for the rest of your life, and you illustrate that and complete it in the sexual union where you become one flesh. In the Bible, this relationship is a covenant. It's not a contract, because a contract you can renegotiate, or you can say, I will end this contract and I will have a contract with someone else. marriage is a covenant, and several places in the Bible uses that kind of terminology. It's a covenant. It's on a higher level. You're committed on a different level than when you sign a contract. Of course, we know it's a fallen world. We know that marriage falls apart. So I'm not denying that. But the view of marriage is that it is a covenant. It's a covenant that is created by public promises and is confirmed in the sexual union. I again and again meet Christians who have heard teaching out from 1 Corinthians 6. So they have learned that if you have sex with someone, the sexual act constitutes the marriage. I think that is wrong. I think it's unbiblical. And it's also totally impossible to take seriously. You know, if I look around in my culture, and I would think that people were married to everyone they have had sex to, that would be a totally chaotic worldview. Sex with someone you are not married to is in the Bible, if you use the Greek word, is called porneia. It's an illicit sexual relationship, but it's not the marriage. The marriage is created by public promises, and that's why when you go to marriage, and the bride and the bridegroom have expressed their vows and said yes, then the officiant says, "I hereby declare you man and wife." So the marriage is established by the public promises, and they are then confirmed by the sexual union. And in the New Testament, that this view, I would say, is taken for granted, and we are called to honor marriage and to encourage each other to keep the marriage bed pure. Now, in our culture, marked by the sexual revolution, this way of thinking, which means that you limit sexual relationships to male-female lifelong covenant relationships to marriage, is, of course, a really strange view. It's a really strange view. And people will scorn it or just reject it. But I think too few have thought through the issues, because I would say that this Christian view that sex belongs to the marriage relationship actually takes seriously what we all know about sex. Namely, two things. That sex is a unique bodily act. You cannot compare it to other bodily acts. It's a category on its own. And we know that in our legal system, we know that in our public debate, as soon as we discuss rape, then everyone immediately acknowledges this cannot be equal to physical assault. This is something different on a level of principles. If someone hits you in the stomach, that's one thing. But very few people have trauma a decade later because they were hit in the stomach. But you think about rape. The sexual act touches something much deeper in us as persons, because it's designed for a unique function. And therefore, it's obvious for everyone that it's not an act like all other physical acts. It's something more, deeper, more beautiful, but also more sensitive and possibly more damaging if used in the wrong way. And the Christian faith takes this seriously, underlining, yes, it's a unique bodily act which belongs to a unique form of relationship, not to every relationship, not to every person, but between two persons who have joined a covenant. And within that covenant, you express yourself sexually. And secondly, it has a unique function in a real love relationship. So, people in my culture, they have a lot of, or several, or many sexual relationships during their teenage years or during the student years. And then when they maybe are 25 or 28 years, they finally find the person they really want to share their life with. And immediately at that point, sex takes on a new dimension. Suddenly, it is seen as a sign of exclusive belonging. Previously, in many relationships, it was just physical pleasure. Now, sex becomes the sign between the two lovers, and a sexual relationship with someone else threatens, undermines the whole relationship, because then the sign of our belonging together is then taken outside that and given to someone else, which questions the whole relationship. So when people really want to share life with someone, then it seems like sex immediately takes on this function of sign of belonging. Now, that is what the Christian view secures. That is what the Christian view is saying. Yes, it is a sign of belonging. In the film Vanilla Sky with Tom Cruise, in the film, he has relationship with several women. One of them is Cameron Diaz. Well, or the actress Cameron Diaz. Tom Cruise plays a character called David. Cameron Diaz plays a woman called Julie. And they become lovers. But when Julie discovers that David also has a relationship with Sophia, she's, of course, devastated. And she says this: "Don't you know that when you sleep with someone, your body makes a promise whether you do or not?" I think that captures it very well. Don't you know that when you sleep with someone, your body makes a promise whether you do or not? Because the body says, "I belong to you. I'm one with you." And the Christian view is, of course, that we shouldn't say with our body what we are not prepared to say publicly with our mouth. We want the coherent picture of sex and love and bodies. I saw this on Twitter. I don't know. I don't remember who said it, but it's a good quote. "Men, if you're not man enough to love her, marry her and raise your kids with her, then you are not man enough to have sex with her." I think that's a statement that more men should think about in our culture. If you're not man enough to love her, marry her and raise your kids with her, then you're not man enough to have sex with her. In his comment on Exodus, Douglas Stewart says this: "The Bible forbids sexual relations outside of marriage, but requires it within marriage, demonstrating that marriage represents a genuinely different state from singleness in God's eyes. with sexual intimacy serving as the covenant seal of marriage and regular sexual relations functioning as a small scale but important and required periodic marriage covenant renewal. And I think that's a good point. Sex within a marriage have a similar function as the Lord's Supper have in our relationship to Christ, a repeated, continually covenantal renewal, where we where the belonging together is reaffirmed. And sex has that as a very important part in the marriage. That is why it's so. That is why it's so wrong to use it as something just. I'm losing the English word. Just to have one night stands. Just to use it selfish. For your own gratification. And I think we know, or at least people know, if they can live a little bit longer and they finally find someone they want to live with, they discover this function of sex as the renewal of the covenant you have with the other person. So that would be a kind of overview of the biblical view of sex.